From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are living in an age of contradictions. Take the COVID-19 pandemic. We have life-saving vaccines and proven treatments, and yet more than a million people have died, many of them after those vaccines and treatments became widely available. Or you can look at the contradictions in politics. There are people who, in 2008 and 2012, looked at Barack Obama and thought, yes, that is the best person to lead our country. Then, when Donald Trump came along, they thought, yes, this is also the best person to lead our country. Or think about this. There are people out there who base a significant part of their identity on backing underdogs, like those who root for the Cubs through more than a century of loss. And yet those people cannot make the leap to supporting other kinds of underdogs in our society, like, say, undocumented immigrants or people who don't conform to traditional ideas of gender. There's a way of looking at all these things as failures of persuasion. And that's why I've been excited for today's conversation since I first learned about a new book on the subject. It's called The Persuaders at the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. And the author is Anand Giridharadas, and he joins me now. Anand, welcome to The 21st Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. I'm glad to be with you.
And listeners, I want to invite you to join our conversation as well today at 800-222-9455. And as the conversation unfolds, I suspect a lot of you are going to be hearing yourselves in what we talk about today. But if there are people in your life who you think are beyond persuasion or beyond reasoning with, maybe you've written them off over politics, we want to hear from you at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455, or tweet us at 21st Show. So I want to get to the book. I want to spend most of our time talking about it. But since we are in the midst of still getting returns for the 2022 elections, I wanted to ask your perspective on what happened this year. What is your top line reaction to what we've learned about the outcomes so far?
Well, I think it was a profoundly reassuring night if you like democracy, if you enjoy your freedoms. And I think where this election was particularly pronounced as a referendum on freedom, the freedom over one's body, the freedom to choose leaders who will solve your problems instead of have those leaders chosen by, you know, themselves. Freedom really worked as a message. Freedom was kind of resoundingly successful as a referendum. People rejected the kind of Trumpist election fiddlers. People rejected the thieves of women's bodily freedom. And so that was good. You know, I think at the heart of what I'm writing about in The Persuaders, though, is a fear that this battle against American fascism, which is what we're in, is not over when we win a presidential election or have a decent or even surprisingly good midterm result. This is going to be a long, grinding battle for the soul of the country. And I believe right now, pro-democracy, pro-freedom forces sometimes have a good day, sometimes have a bad day, but have not decisively figured out how to outcompete and bury American fascism. And I'm interested in some of the ways that I learned from these persuaders I write about in how it might be able to do that.
I love how you're framing that as pro-freedom and not as anti-fascism, which is something you write about in the book, and we can talk about that later. But I wonder if there are standout examples of, you know, familiar names, candidates that people would recognize around the country who did the work of persuasion that you're writing about.
Yeah, I you know, the way I think about it is there is kind of, I wrote about a handful of persuaders who I think are doing things in ways that are more likely to work and that are showing better results than the rest of us in this polarized time. Because as you say, everybody in Illinois listening to this and around the country has these relatives, has these colleagues. We're all stuck in this one way or another, and we need better strategies. I think we can all agree on that. And so I wrote about, you know, some of the, a kind of organizer's playbook that emerges from these characters I spent time with. And so when I look around the country, even in these midterms, I see different people doing different elements of the playbook well. So one of the elements of the playbook is command attention, right? I think the far right is often very good at commanding attention and forcing people to have its conversation, forcing people to be on its conversational terms. And often the left has a kind of high-mindedness about not being tacky, not being stunty, not commanding attention. But I think if you look at someone like Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, who I read about in the book, she's very good at that. She shows a different way for Democrats. I think there are many Democrats on the ballot who are showing a different way for their movement. I think another one is, you know, an element of the playbook is picking fights. You know, with all due respect to the great Illinois citizen, Michelle Obama, you know, that notion of when they go low, we go high. I think it's a fabulous philosophy for raising children. It's something that I teach my children. I don't know that it is a appropriate strategy against the kind of fascists we now are up against. And I think you see in Gavin Newsom, governor of California, and particularly in his post-recall persona, you saw moments of this from others. A willingness to pick fights really resonates with people right now. Pick generative fights. I think you saw in someone like Josh Shapiro a willingness to frame some of the issues like democracy in ways that were kind of better at meeting people where they are, which is another element of the playbook. He did a great job of not doing kind of democracy lectures, which sometimes leave people cold, but really talking about freedom, which, as I write about in the book, feels corporeal to people. People can feel and touch and smell freedom. And he did a great job of pulling that in. You know, I think John Fetterman did something that I, as a candidate for senator from Pennsylvania, I write about in the book, which is don't try to persuade by diluting what you stand for, by standing for something less or moderate or milquetoast, mushy middle. Persuade by standing firmly and bravely in your truth, in ambitious demands for the kind of world we deserve. And then at the same time, reach out to people through how you carry yourself, through how you communicate, through how you frame things. And finally, I would say, you know, one of the most important elements of the playbook I talk about is telling the better story about America, telling a story about America that is more thrilling, more galvanizing than the other side, not living in reaction to this fascist movement that in many ways is a kind of movement of barnacles on progress we have made and are making, but telling a patriotic, galvanizing story that centers the idea of liberty and justice for all that so many of us are pursuing. You know, and I think you had in Beto O'Rourke, even though he lost, you had in actually all kinds of candidates across this country. I think Fetterman was another, a kind of progressive patriotism that is notable, not accepting being labeled by a kind of increasingly fascistic right as self-hating or unpatriotic, but in fact, a patriotism that is self-confident enough to invite everyone in. So Barack those Obama are some of the this, those are some of the practitioners I saw.
Yeah, Barack Obama did a lot of that, right? Reclaiming the American flag lapel pin. There's nothing wrong with America that can't be fixed by what's right with America.
That well, I mean, that was a Bill Clinton line, and Obama did wear the flag pin, but he wore it reluctantly, you know, and was kind of pushed. And I think what's interesting there is I think sometimes we have a bit of an allergy on the political left to manifestations of patriotism. And I think this is a big problem. I don't understand. I mean, I come out of an America whose founding documents are awesome, said some really amazing things that had not been said in founding documents of countries in history until then. And the country was also founded by a bunch of people who were not brave enough. As the artist Dewey Crumpler said to me not long ago for a piece I was writing, not brave enough to live up to what they promised. It doesn't indict their promises. From the beginning of the history of this country, as Nicole Hannah-Jones and others have written, marginalized people living with unrequited love for America, loving America when America wouldn't love them back, have forced America to live up to those founding ideals, those beautiful, awe-inspiring words. And that is my patriotism. My patriotism is the patriotism of those concepts, those words, that idea of natural human equality, of the pursuit of a more perfect union. My patriotism is the patriotism of everybody who has fought to make those words true, who have extended the blessings of liberty and justice to more people every generation. And I refuse to concede patriotism to people who shoot beer bottles in their backyard to cosplay for some kind of wannabe civil war, or to, you know, parents who you know, don't love their children enough to continue loving them when their hearts answer to a different name, or when they turn out to be gay, or when they, you know, turn out to be different from what the parents had in mind. My patriotism is the patriotism of loving other people's kids more than some of those intolerant parents are willing to love their own kids.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Anand Giridharadas, who is the author of The Persuaders at the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. All right, let's start with the problem that is at the heart of your book, and that is this idea out there that persuasion is not worthwhile or maybe not even possible anymore. And there's a line early on that I'm going to paraphrase it, but you say, a lot of people view those who think differently as needing to be resisted rather than won over. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think we all know that there's something kind of tense and angry in our political discourse right now, that it's a polarized time, that we're divided. It's not just national politics. Everyone listening to this will have that uncle or that sibling or that coworker. But as I really dug into the reporting on kind of where we are in this polarized age, it seemed to me that we had gone, there was a further wrinkle. We'd gone one step further beyond anger and kind of division, that we were moving into a territory of contempt and dismissal. And, you know, if you're casually driving down the highway listening to this, anger and division may seem quite similar to contempt and dismissal. And I want to argue to you that they're not similar. Anger and division actually is kind of normal in politics. Politics is supposed to be hard. It's about the hardest things under the sun. It's going to get real, right? I mean, it's about, if we have $1,000 left in the treasury, do we take care of your ailing parents first or my children's education, right? It's not ever going to be a cakewalk. It is a negotiation about the future, about what we deserve, about what we owe each other. Anger and division are fine, right? I think contempt and dismissal is when you start to hear people say, ugh, don't bother with those people. They'll never change. They will always think that way because they're white. They will always think that way because they voted for Trump. They'll always think that way because they're an immigrant. They'll always think that way because they, thought that way once about the vaccine. The problem with contempt and dismissal, when they become widespread political sentiments, first of all, any marriage counselor will tell you, a marriage can totally survive anger and division and just conflict. It's in fact healthy to have conflict in a marriage. A marriage often cannot survive contempt and dismissal. That's the beginning of the end for a marriage. Well, that's what's happening in our body politic. The second problem with contempt and dismissal becoming this kind of great write-off that I write about, becoming dominant emotions in this country, is that it's empirically false that people don't change their mind, right? If you are a gay person of a certain age, I'm pretty sure that when you looked at the world as a young person, you did not imagine the kind of mind change that would happen in your lifetime in this country. I've heard this again and again from folks in the LGBT community. So people's minds do change. People's mind, I think that we are living through a racial reckoning, as fraught as it is, where millions of white people have absolutely reflected on race, thought about race, grappled with race in a way that their parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents as white people in this country never thought about for 2 seconds. I bet you so many people listening to this have thought about what it means to be white in a way that is new in the history of their families. I bet a lot of people listening to this are men who have accepted that a lot of the old ways of being men didn't work if you want to actually be a good person who allows women to thrive and flourish. A lot of men are resisting these changes, but a lot of men listening to this, I guarantee you, are new men in certain ways, or have broken with some of the ways of the past that were inconsistent with being good and equal citizens with the women in our lives. So people change all the time. And when people who want a different kind of world start to succumb to the fatalism that people can't change, they are writing off democracy itself. They're writing off the idea of changing things through changing minds. And I wrote The Persuaders because I refuse to accept that this country has no future, this democracy has no future. And so I went out in search of people who I think can show us how we save democracy, how we realize its promise, and how we do all of that by reclaiming the idea of persuading and becoming in our own lives better persuaders.
We need to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation when we come back. We are talking with Anand Giridharadas, who is the author of The Persuaders at the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. I want to invite you to join our conversation today. Maybe you have Thanksgiving dinner coming up, and how are you going to handle Uncle Hannity when he wants to bring up the election returns this year? Let us know at 800-222-9455. We are going to have some practical advice about being a persuader in your life, as well as hearing some of the stories that Anand tells in his book of the many people who are doing this work out in the country. Again, 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. More to come with Anand Giridharadas after a short break. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking with Anand Giridharadas, who is the author of The Persuaders at the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. The book is structured as a series of profiles, really, of people who are doing the difficult work of persuasion out there in the country, not writing off their fellow Americans as deplorables, as people beyond convincing, people who need to be beaten down instead of brought along or won over to their cause. A lot of them are women of color, which is an interesting choice, in particularly at this time when they have been asked to do a lot, just organizing in their own work they're doing locally. And let's talk about Loretta Ross. And I love this idea of imperfect allies and circles of influence, right? 90%ers. Talk about her ideas there.
Yeah, Loretta Ross is one of these women of color who I center in this book as I think having something to say about persuasion that is different from a lot of the norm. I think when we think about persuasion, often we think about diluting our demands, watering down the world we want in order to appeal to people who are skeptical or kind of in the middle. And a lot of these women of color activists in particular who I'm writing about have a different theory of persuasion that I'm trying to uplift in this book. Loretta Ross is a veteran activist on racial justice, gender justice, reproductive justice, a term she helped coin. She's in her 70s, and she's at a stage in her life where she has a lot to teach the movement. She's a respected elder in these many movements that she is part of, and has spent her life thinking about how do you get real, fundamental, in many cases, radical change done, but also build a constituency for it. And as she has looked out on today's movements as a kind of elder and mentor figure, she became concerned that there was this kind of inability of members of a broad coalition to hang together and do things together. And so she talks about this notion of circles of influence, which I think is very powerful. She says, basically, look, if you are broadly part of a struggle to make the world better, to make most people's lives better, you have different types of potential allies, and you need to be able to ally with those different types of allies, depending on who they are to you and their relationship to you, right? So your 90%ers are people who basically agree with you on everything. And we all have those people in our lives. But the reason they're 90%ers instead of 100 is they may have a different angle on the problem, right? They may work at the same issue from a race lens instead of an economic lens, or they may work on it, you know, in one area, and whereas you work on it in another. And one of the problems she observes in her spaces is sometimes 90%ers kind of criticize each other for not attacking the problem the same way they attack the problem. And her critique there is, there's a lot of work to do. There's a lot of work to go around. Be a good partner, be a good coalition buddy to people who broadly agree with you and are just pursuing different methods. Then there's your 75%ers, right? Which are people you have broad, you know, broad topical kind of values you share with them. But when it comes to the specifics, you might not. So for example, Loretta Ross says she and the Girl Scouts organization, I mean, very much share a general view of the empowerment of women as a important fundamental value. Now, when you get into brass tacks, you know, how loudly are you going to go around defending the right to abortion? Loretta Ross and the Girl Scouts may differ, right? One of them may not, the Girl Scouts may not want to be front and center of that issue or may not have her position. The question there becomes, should Loretta Ross like partner with the Girl Scouts on driving out young women's vote? Or is she somehow complicit in, you know, the reluctance of the Girl Scouts on abortion by getting in bed with them? And she says very clearly, she's of the view, like, do the thing you can with your 75%ers and like bracket the things you can't. Don't get into this thing where you can't, you know, do anything with them because you can't do everything with them. Then your 50%ers are people who, you know, they don't really share any of your kind of political beliefs, but they maybe share some core beliefs around, you know, America's a country where everybody who works hard should get ahead, or people should be free to determine the shape of their own lives, or, you know, the government should not like actively persecute people who are powerless. Those kind of broad, very basic values that are almost pre-political, but very much political. And she says, with those people, you have to kind of really hook what you're trying to do into their values, not trying to lecture them on your values. So her father, a veteran, he never really believed Loretta's advocacy on universal health care. He thought it was, you know, a big government program. He's kind of a libertarian guy. And then when his veterans health care, he was once Elvis Presley's drill sergeant, by the way, fun fact, when his veterans health care kind of collapsed and was revealed to be more threadbare than he had realized, he was suddenly up for a conversation with Loretta about the idea of healthcare being a human right in a way that that frame had not appealed to him before. You have to also know the right moments when people are there. And then finally, there's your 25%ers, who are people who really share no fundamental values with you, but the last resource you have with 25%ers, who you may or may not even need to persuade on a given issue, is that they want to be seen as good people. They want to go to bed feeling that they're good people. And maybe your sense of whether they're good people is somewhat important to them, right? And so, you know, with those folks, when something like family separation happens under the Trump administration, that's maybe the resource you have. Maybe they don't agree with you on the border in general. Maybe they don't agree with you about the president, but their desire to be good people comes up for them. And they might get to a place of this is not who we are on something like family separation, which creates an opportunity. So I learned a lot from Loretta about the ability to hang with people who are not your perfect allies and do something with them. Of course, the most dramatic example she offers is when she was working at a rape crisis center in Washington, D.C. She got a letter from a rapist in prison saying, I raped women on the outside. Now I rape men on the inside. Can you help me stop raping? And her first thought was, who the hell are you to ask a woman running a rape crisis center to devote my resources to you, a rapist? And then she thought about it more and she said, what are we doing here if we're not trying to reduce rape in the world? So she went in there, she and others started leading these seminars where they read feminist texts with these rapists. It spread all around prisons around this country and was a remarkable reforming process. That's the kind of thing that happens when you retain a faith that I think all the persuaders I'm writing about in this book maintain, which is a faith that people change.
I do want to talk about, and you bring out in the book, this is a big ask for people, though, in a lot of cases, yep. Right? Especially people of color, especially women of color. And you write about some people who, you know, were maybe persuaded to take on some of this work against their better judgment, right? Can you talk about that burden?
Look, one of the things that Loretta says very clearly is only do work that you want to do. Only do work you are healed enough to do, right? And the reality is, it is not going to be for most people of color to go talk to white people about racism. That's absolutely fine. That's what Netflix is for, right? It is not for most women to go talk to men about patriarchy and sexism, right? It is not for most trans people to go talking to cis people about their reality. However, a minority of people from these marginalized groups have now and have always wanted to go do that work, right? And a small minority of folks wanting to do that work can have a pretty significant effect on the world. So every single activist and organizer I write about in the book says very clearly, no one has to do this. No one should have to do this. However, I think a lot of them believe that some of us will have to have conversations that we may not enjoy, but choose affirmatively to have them for the sake of the country. And I think one of my mantras, Brian, is that one of the kind of principles of citizenship for me, maybe the definition of citizenship for me, is accepting that what is not your fault may be your problem. It is not my fault that it is hard for lots of white Americans who were trained in a time when there was little awareness of race in their spaces and conversations and education, that it's hard for them to transition to a society with different norms, with more equality, a society where we have to share with people we were not raised to share with. That's not my fault. I do believe it's my problem. It's my problem in the sense of if I don't view that as a shared responsibility, the way I view, you know, helping coal workers figure out who they are on the far side of solving climate, or helping manufacturing people figure out who they are on the far side of the rise of China. You know, we have all a shared interest in helping people figure out who they will be on the far side of change. And if we don't do that, when we don't do that, we leave a lot of people seething and resentful and eager to burn the country down instead of share it. That is a shared obligation. And for those who are listening to this, for those who are reading the book and thinking, I could do that. I have the stomach to do that. There is some amazing work you can do.
Well, and one of the guides to that amazing work is someone who is not a household name. I have to admit, I was not aware of their work before I read about it in your book. And that is Anat Shankar Osorio. If I'm saying that right, and please correct me if not. But this is, you characterize them as like a Frank Luntz of the left, right? If people on the left listened to people like Frank Luntz.
Yes, she, Anat Shankar Osorio, who grew up not super far from you in Wisconsin, is a message guru, as you say, the Frank Luntz of the left, if the left listened to its Frank Luntzes, and is someone who is thinking, you know, a message can sometimes be, in politics, can be kind of misunderstood as a small or trivial thing. Messages is really, how do you, in a democracy, communicate to voters in a way that reflects what their values are, that implicates the deepest things they feel? How do you, you know, pluck the strings of their heart instead of simply lecturing people about policies and bullet points and, you know, 50-point plans and all these things that Democrats are incredibly good at doing? How do you actually say things in a way that people can process them?
Let me ask you about as you are appealing to people, you go on at some length about the middle and appealing to the middle. And one of the stories you include in the book is Aesop's fable about the miller who heads to the market with his son to sell his donkey. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, this is an analogy from Anat about the Democratic Party, and you know, the miller is heading the market with the son. You know, at one point the son is riding on the donkey and the miller is walking, and people criticize that, you know, the son let it making his father walk. So then they switch it. Father gets on the donkey and the son walks, and people criticize that. And, you know, this father just enjoying the donkey to himself while making his son walk. What kind of family is this? You know, and so finally, I think I forget whether neither of them is on it or they're both on it, but the donkey is kind of lost down a hillside. And, you know, as the story goes, they lost their ass besides. And so, you know, this is a story of a Democratic Party that is often so scared of appealing to, in particular, the working class white vote in the middle, that it will contort itself endlessly to appeal to them. And one of the things Anant Shankar-Osorio is trying to do that I hope folks will really absorb is to completely change our understanding of what a moderate is. In her telling, a moderate is not someone who is in the exact middle. If you identify as a moderate listening to this, I would bet that your politics is not exactly at the halfway point between whatever the two sides are offering at a given moment. A moderate, in her telling, is someone who can be toggled into a very conservative understanding of the world in certain circumstances when made certain arguments, and a person who can be toggled into a very progressive understanding of the world under different circumstances with different arguments. You in Illinois know that when Barack Obama presented himself for president, it wasn't that racism ended in America. It was that a lot of people, and certainly a subset of quite racist people, didn't abandon their racism, but they loved Barack Obama. Right. And I remember speaking to Obama aides who were like, that's when we knew we were winning. Right. When we were winning a significant chunk of the racist vote. Right. So what it means to understand moderates as people who can be swayed, as people who can be moved by a charismatic candidate, be moved by kind of fun, exuberant, dystopian movement claiming to smash the system, but with really kind of engaging rallies, can be moved by high inflation, can be moved by, you know, by a kind of terrorist attack that makes them feel afraid for their safety, can be moved by crime. This is the kind of voter that we need to focus on, and we need to stop trying to get them by diluting what we're offering, by cutting the legs off of our ambitions, but instead try to reach people by making a case to them that the world we're offering is more compelling, is more exciting. Our party is a more fun party to be at, and I'm speaking at party in the sense of cocktails and snacks, that it's a more joyous, more welcoming, more exuberant movement. Come on in.
Absolutely. The commentator David Plotz, who used to be an editor of Slate, he's on one of their podcasts now, he has this hypothesis that the political party that's having the most fun or appears to be having the most fun is probably going to win an election. And I think
piece by Amanda Marcotte in Slate talking about book bans by the Republican Party and abortion bans. And she said, look, if Democrats cannot win on the message of we want you to curl up with a good book and get laid, we don't deserve to win.
All right. We are going to take another break, and I want to invite listeners to join our conversation again at 800-222-9455. We're talking with Anand Giridharadas, who is the author of The Persuaders at the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. I want to leave you with a question, Anand, and when we come back, we can answer it. We got this on Twitter. Somebody asked, they're so excited to hear your creative ideas. Their question is, what do you think about the concern about division, popularly called polarization, and is it negative? Because this person says they're inclined to look at it as a healthy sign of conscience among white people especially. We're going to answer that question when we come back. More with Anand Giridharadas. Again, the book is The Persuaders at the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455, or you can find us on Twitter at 21STShow, at 21st Show. More to come. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're speaking with Anand Giridharadas, who is the author of The Persuaders at the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. Anand, I set you up with a Twitter question before the break. I'll remind listeners, basically it was a question about division, polarization. Is that necessarily a bad thing? This person saw it as a healthy sign of conscience among white people especially. What do you think about that?
Yeah. And I will say, by the way, get your calls ready, because I've heard, I don't want to get any unhealthy competition going on, but I've heard Illinois callers on public radio are better than other states caller. So I just want to, you know, put that out there as folks start to dial in. But we'll deal with the Twitter question first. Look, it's a great question. And I deeply agree with this premise. This is not, as I said, a kumbaya book. I don't think the problem in America is that we are like, you know, like too mad or too, you know, like we're dealing with some really hard stuff, right? We're dealing with historic levels of inequality that have stolen the American dream and made it something you have to fly to Europe to access, right? We are dealing with, you know, a racial reckoning that is really about, can we stop being what we have been for 400 years, which is a society standing on the necks of Black people. I mean, I can't imagine a world in which one could properly face these issues, properly face, you know, the question of how do you dismantle patriarchal social structures and allow women to live their fullest and best and freest lives. None of these things are supposed to be easy. They're all going to be hard, and people are going to be tense about these shifts regardless. So I agree that it's going to get real. I think what I am reacting to and wrote this book about is when that curdles into a fatalism about people being unreachable, people never changing. It is one thing to say your stance on that issue is awful, is terrible, and I'm gonna work to convince you, I'm gonna work to convince other people. It is another thing to say, ugh, men will never change. Ugh, immigrants will always vote for Democrats. We got to just restrict immigration. Whatever the pose is, a kind of view of people as little robots who can't be reached, who can't be moved. And I think that is much more dangerous because it suggests basically that you don't believe in the core activity of democracy, which is changing minds in order to change things. I think when we give up on persuasion, we are beginning to walk down that road to political violence, to tyranny, to civil war.
All right, let's go to the phones. Jonathan is calling on line four from Pekin, Illinois. Jonathan, thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for answering my call.
So go ahead and what do you have a question for Anand?
Yes, I'm currently within the U.S. military, and during my deployment, I've worked very closely with the equal opportunity groups. And we recently actually had somebody come in that was that recently came out as trans, and we've had issues in the past fostering a more welcoming community, even within the LGBT to people that are actually within the military. And I guess my question would be, what would you do to persuade people that restricting those, making it a less welcoming environment is not only important for non-LGBTQ people, but also for LGBT members of the military?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I love that question. Second of all, let me reflect on the beauty of living in a country, living in a moment when a member of the US military is calling in and saying, how can my fighting force be more loving and inclusive of the breadth of humanity that lives in this country and fights to defend it, right? That was not a question our parents were asking, right? So I'm proud to live in a moment in which we're asking that question. I salute you for asking that question. And I would say, you know, I think on those issues, there's been so much amazing advocacy done. I think we sometimes have to remind people who are more wary of those kinds of pursuits of equality and justice that, for example, trans people in the military, I mean, who is braver? It's an institution that values bravery, right? Who is braver than someone who, at least in past years, now it's gotten easier, was often lying simply to be able to serve their country, not telling people their real identity, simply to be able to serve. I've interviewed trans soldiers who lived in secret because they wanted to serve their country, right? Who is braver than that? Who is braver than people from small towns in this country who know who they are and are frankly willing to walk away from families who won't love them, who won't tend to them the way families ought to, simply to live in truth with who they are? If you value core American values around self-determination, around freedom, around, you know, holding your truths to be self-evident, then trans people are the fulfillment of that, particularly when they serve in the military and risk their lives and bodies for this country. And I think we need to sometimes frame these fights not as SJW social justice warrior fights, but these are fights to be American in the fullest and bravest sense of it. And look, you know, we are, in as a human species, always resistant at first to, you know, having more people sit by us at the campfire. That's just a bad feature of us. But in the long run, we have added so many types of people to the campfire. Our levels of inclusion today make our ancestors look like quite small-hearted people. And I think we will get there again. But I think it begins with trying to understand what are people so afraid of, right? And trying to stir up, as many of the persuaders I write about in the book, stir up dissonance within them. Is your aversion, is your contempt for trans people, is that not inconsistent with some of these other things you believe? And if so, how do those two things square with you? And often what you find is that people do move and change on those issues.
Jonathan, thank you so much for that question. That was a great jumping off point for the rest of our conversation. And I want to ask about so practical tips, right? You have, so the book is there, and there's a lot we didn't get to that I wish we could talk a little bit more about if we had more time. But, you know, there's this, you know, the idea of persuading people with different beliefs. And then now we're in this environment where we also have to persuade people with different facts. But you offer some practical tips, and people, if they want to, they can go to your website, thepersuadersbook.com, to either look up the book itself or download a pamphlet you have that offers some like very practical tips. Let's say somebody is going to that Thanksgiving dinner later this month and they are not looking forward to talking politics with, Uncle Tucker at the Thanksgiving table. What advice do you have for them?
Look, I think, this is, as you rightly say, this is a book about these big shifts, but it's also a shift about, the persuaders is also about what you can do. So let me give you a couple of these kinds of strategies for the more personal situations in your life. You know, and I'll frame them as kind of the do's and don'ts. Do recognize that people who disagree with you are complicated too. Don't treat them as immovable monoliths. This one is a really important one, and it's something that I think virtually everybody who I was writing about in The Persuaders does correctly. It's about, you know, recognize that, you know, you're complicated, recognize they're complicated too, and that there may be some other B side in them that feels differently about an issue. Try to build that up. Don't try to implant your view in them like a microchip. If you've been married, you know, that doesn't work, but do try to stir up their own dissonance. Second, do call people into the future you want. Don't call people out for not getting it yet. I think a lot of us, a lot of movements for progress are better at calling people out for not getting it than calling people in. Third, do amplify what you're for and help people see it. Don't live in perpetual reaction mode to the other side's outrages. A lot of us are living in perpetual reaction mode these days, reacting to every new thing Trump says or someone else says. And we're not using that moment of airtime in our family or on television to say what we're for, to say what the world looks like if we win. We're not engaging in the kind of evocative storytelling that is so important for particularly defeating some of the dangerous movements around. There's more. Do long-term trust building. Don't try to change a mind in a day. Don't try to out-argue your climate change denier uncle with facts in a day. Try to build a kind of relationship of trust that can withstand you trying to, at some point, lovingly intervene and say you're being misled by people. Do distinguish disinformation victims from its perpetrators. Don't make the duped and manipulated feel stupid. We're very bad at this often. We treat our climate denier uncle as badly as Rupert Murdoch because the climate denier uncle is the one we can reach and access. Your uncle is a victim of Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch is a perpetrator. Treat them with appropriate moral difference. And lastly, get offline and get doing. Organize, canvas, associate, don't give in to hopelessness. You know, one of the things, I wrote this book because I was tired of despair. I was tired of my own funk. And The Persuaders is a manifesto to buck up and get moving. This we can take back this country from these wannabe tyrants and fascists, but it's going to require organizing as we have never organized before. It's going to require a freedom movement of a kind we've never seen before. And I believe we can do it, but we gotta get going. And there is incredible work. There's a group called People's Action out of Chicago, Illinois, where incredible work is being done around the country on something called deep canvassing, which I write about in the book. That's something anyone listening to this can sign up for online, get trained in, and go do. There's many number of things you can do to be part of building a movement to outcompete fascism that is bigger, better, feistier, more magnanimous, more rooted, and frankly, just more powerful.
Yeah, deep canvassing, that was a fascinating section. You can see people changing in the moment, you know, in the moment, on the doorstep. In the time we have remaining, you brought up something. Get out there, right? Get out there, organize, do something. Politics has become a hobby for so many people, like a sport almost, right? They don't cheer for baseball. They follow politics now. Talk about that, the failure to view politics as being about power in the couple minutes we have remaining.
Yeah, I mean, I think the internet has created a temptation to feel like you are extremely engaged when you are in fact merely kind of standing in a kind of windstream of chatter, right? On social media, on watching television, watching YouTube videos. And there's a kind of, you know, as people have written about political hobbyism that takes hold. And, you know, the Democratic Party, I think, shows up in people's lives primarily as like an annoying emailer that is just constantly asking you for $5. Like, there's a risk of being an extremely online movement. The extremist right in America is an IRL movement. They exist online, but they also exist in real life. There are evangelical church networks that meet up and hang out. There are hunting and fishing clubs, there's the Federalist Society, there's homeschooling associations. There's any number of ways in which the right drops its abstract convictions down into the daily rhythms of people's lives. And I think the left has in many ways become removed from any kind of physical presence. It's not really an IRL movement. You know, as the writer Bhaskar Sunkara has written, the center-left and left parties that won in the 20th century were so rooted and organized that they would have had a representative in every building in major cities, right? You got a confusing letter from the IRS, you'd go up to Gilda on the third floor and she would, you know, the Democratic Party lady on the third floor would like help you figure out your confusing IRS letter. How remote does that sound from our life right now? The equivalent now is being emailed by the DCCC on an email list of 5 million people told that you are, you know, sabotaging America because you haven't given $5 yet today. So we need to completely build from top to bottom an actually rooted party and a rooted anti-fascist movement that is in community, that is inviting people to things, that is hanging out, an IRL movement for democracy, for freedom, that can outcompete fascism and send the fascists, you know, where they belong, which is, you know, back into the history books.
Anand Giridharadas, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Anand Giridharadas is the author of The Persuaders, At the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. We'll have a link to the book and that pamphlet we were talking about if you want to download it. You can join his email listserv. He publishes articles, I think, weekly. And you can do that at our website, which is 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. And that's all the time we have for our program today. I mentioned our website. While you're there, you can let us know what you thought about our show. You can email us, leave a voicemail, find our social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc. And you can also subscribe to our podcast while you're there. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Just search for The 21st. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Anaya Jones, Zainab Qureshi, and Owen Henderson. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We will talk with you again on Monday.